Welcome to Let It Roll, the podcast about how and why popular music happens with host Nate Wilcox. Be sure and subscribe to the Let It Roll podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Podomatic, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. You can now follow us on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and we'd love to hear what you think, so don't be shy about tweeting at us or commenting on our website. This week, author David Ritz joins Nate to discuss his book, The God Groove, A Blues Journey to Faith. David is without question the greatest ghostwriter in pop history, having partnered with Ray Charles, Marvin Gaye, Aretha Franklin, Rick James, B.B. King, Buddy Guy, Etta James, Janet Jackson, Willie Nelson, and Grandmaster Flash, among many others. In this episode, David tells Nate about his experiences, including persuading Ray Charles to let him ghostwrite Brother Ray, co-writing one of Marvin Gaye's biggest hits, the joys and frustrations of working with Aretha Franklin, and the spiritual advice he got from believers like Smokey Robinson, Willie Nelson, and Janet Jackson. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
Time to let it roll. Today I'm joined by author David Ritz, author of The God Groove, and so many books. I got to read some of his bibliography before we start. He's author, the ghostwriter of Brother Ray, the autobiography of Ray Charles. He's the author of the definitive biographies of Marvin Gaye and Aretha Franklin, ghostwritten autobiographies of Rick James, Grandmaster Flash, and many, many more. David, welcome to the show.
I appreciate your having me on.
It's a thrill. I've been reading your books for years, and for so long I didn't realize you existed because you were ghosting so well.
Here I am. The ghost comes alive.
And so the new book, The God Groove, it's subtitled A Blues Journey to Faith, but it's really the autobiography of rock music's greatest ghostwriter.
Well, I appreciate that. That's kind. I don't really know if it's an autobiography because it's kind of short, and it's sort of, I think it's more of a memoir, and I'm not sure I could tell you the difference between autobiography and a memoir, other than to say, I think a memoir is more of like a briefer, a sort of a reflection, and an autobiography is more like a detailed life story, which this isn't. I mean, I just kind of give sort of glimpses of my past, and anyway,
I found it totally compelling, and let's get into it.
That.
You start with, and I got to admit, I was skeptical. You know, I'm trying to get you on to talk about Aretha Franklin or Marvin Gaye or any of your great books, and you want to talk about your religious conversion, and immediately, you know, alarm bells ring, but.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things you emphasize and talking about your spiritual mentors in the book, people like Jesse Coulter and others, is that they didn't proselytize. And I really didn't feel like this book proselytizes. It just tells your story. Yeah, it just tells your story. And it's so your spirituality is so linked to your love of music that I think our listeners will totally be able to relate to that, even if they're atheists like myself or lost in the spirit world. So
okay.
Cool. Well, I want to quote from the introduction briefly.
Okay.
You said that many of these artists led me to another voice I had never expected to hear, the voice of God. Those artists taught me that, ironically, I had always been hearing that voice. The voice was in their music. The voice was in the groove. The ever-changing voice spoke in shouts and whispers, dispensing wisdom about ways to heal the human heart. When did you realize that the music was speaking to you on just a spiritual level as well as a pleasure level?
I think it always was, but I wasn't prepared to call it that. I mean, in other words, just from a gut level, you know, I remember when I was 12 or 13 and I heard the Sam Cooke or the Staple Singers. I remember their early albums. I would listen to them again and again. And I didn't know what to do. I was so excited and sort of thrilled and overjoyed by them. And, Now, that's also true of jazz. I mean, so it isn't just African-American gospel music that got to me, that got me to a point where I went, oh, my God, I don't know how to express the joy this is giving me. I mean, it was also true of Charlie Parker and Lester Young and a whole bunch of people. But, you know, I grew up in a Jewish secular household, and my dad was an intellectual and a Marxist. And so, you know, I had all this kind of, you know, built in prejudice against calling it God or anything. I mean, it was just art, you know. And so my dad, who loved jazz and you know, was the first person to tell me about jazz, and his albums were the first jazz albums I heard, it, you know, helped me articulate this in terms of high art, and so that attitude I kept, and that's the attitude that I basically grew up with. And so my change of attitude came about, as I try to explain in my book, the change of attitude came about when I actually engaged with these artists on a personal level. And, you know, when you're a ghost writer, your job is to channel the voice of another person. And I grew up in a household where the idea was to listen for the pause in the conversation so you can jump in and talk. And that talking was usually about trying to disprove what the other person had just told you. So, I mean, it was this ambient, and it was great. I mean, I don't mean it was terrible, because, you know, there's something to say for kind of dialectic conversational combat, you know, but it wasn't until I became a ghostwriter where my job was just, you know, shut up and listen to these people. And if you're going to do the book well, you have to listen with your heart, because being a ghost writer, I learned, is a peculiar kind of trade. And so their spirit has to interact with your own spirit. And when that happened, you know, when I met, you know, Ray Charles or Marvin Gaye, was, you know, extremely important, because he was only 4 or 5 years older than I was. But any event, to make a long story short, I had to be the witness to other people's spirituality. And then I had to not only hear them, I had to express it in book form. I had to sort of become them. So all of that kind of changed me, and but, you know, we're talking about a long period of time. I mean, I began, I'm 75, and I, you know, probably fell in love with music when I was 8 or 7 or 6, and by the time I was 10 or 11 or 12, I had pretty, you know, I knew, you know, jazz and bop and a whole bunch of stuff, you know, big band stuff. So it wasn't until I was really in my 50s and 60s that I found that I got to the core of it. And I kind of think that's also what this book is about. It's kind of it's like, what is at the core of this music that I love so much? And at the core is this sort of mysterious love. This sounds cornball, but this kind of this mysterious love vibration that I, you know, choose to call God. But I don't care what anybody else calls it. I mean, and that's, in that regard, I'm not a proselytizer, and I think kind of proselytization, if that's even a word, is sort of
is kind of born out of ego. You know, you just want everyone to think the way you do, and I don't care about that at all. But I do care about honoring what I think I've discovered for me, and that music expresses some spiritual energy that is positive and transformative, as in you sing the blues to lose the blues. In other words, you know, you just take the blues, which is basically the form out of which all this comes, and you know, what is the blues? I mean, the blues is a cry, you know, to the heavens or to God, or however you want to put it. But the blues is a transformative musical expression in which the blues man loses the blues by singing the blues. And so I think that's what's happened to me in my life. And I think that happens to me almost every day, that music transforms me and turns negative energy into positive energy. And, you know, I feel like I'm saying a bunch of cliches, but any of it.
Let's hear a song real quick. This is Ray Charles' song, I Got a Woman, which is one of the first songs where he blended his gospel roots with the R&B pop scene. And so we'll hear Ray Charles' I Got a Woman.
Way over town, that's good to me. Oh, yeah. Say, I got a woman way over town, good to me. Oh, yeah. She give me money when I'm in need. Yeah, she's a kind of friend indeed. I got a woman.
And that was Ray Charles' hit single for Atlantic Records, hit on the R&B charts, I Got a Woman. And tell the story. You mentioned that you got the job as a ghostwriter, but you didn't really get a job as a ghostwriter. You made yourself a ghostwriter, and it was difficult. You were obsessed with getting to Ray Charles, and you had a very clever strategy to get past his management. How did you do
it? Well, I mean, I was kind of crazy. I was an ad guy, and I had to get out of advertising, and I was unhappy using my talent to advertise polyester jump suits back in Dallas, where I was where I had this very small agency I opened with some friends. So I sort of made up my mind to come to L.A. and convince Ray Charles to let me write his biography. And because I didn't know about ghost writing, you know, I was trained in college, and in college you learn about biographers, and sometimes they win the Pulitzer Prize and so forth. So I wasn't thinking about being a ghostwriter. Anyway, I came to L.A. I couldn't get through to him. His people were very protective. So I went to Western Union and asked whether you could send a telegram in Braille. And they told me that could. So my attitude was he'd be the only one in the office who could read Braille. I didn't think other people in this office would have taken the time to learn Braille. And it proved to be true. So these Braille telegrams were my pitches to him. You know, I'm here, notes. I'm here in L.A. I'm at the Hot Sheet Motel down the street. You know, I'm crazy about you and your music, and I know a lot about it, and I really want to do your biography. And, you know, I don't know how many telegrams I sent him, but ultimately he called me and said, come over. And I kind of felt as though if I would sort of meet him, that it would be good, because I did think I was persuasive in my genuineness, you know, I mean, and he did. He kind of picked up the idea that I was sincere, though. But of course, the incredible thing, and why everything changed, because, I mean, I hadn't written a book before. I had done academic work. I had done journalism. I had done advertising. But I hadn't written a book. But he didn't care. I mean, he just kind of thought, well, this guy knows a lot about me, and he seems... And my idea was to do a biography, and then I had an agent who told me, do an autobiography, you'll get paid more. And I thought, well, that's important, because I want to make a lot of money, but I don't, you know, I don't know about autobiographies. And then the agent said to me, which book would you rather read, a book written by an egghead kind of biographer or a book written in Ray's own voice about his life? And I said, oh, I'd much rather read a book written in Ray's own voice about his life. And then he said, you should write the book that you want to read, not the one that you believe you should write. So that hit me hard. I said, wow, write the book that I want to read. You know, so and that began the whole thing. And of course, I didn't know how to do it. I had read Lady Sings the Blues, which is ghostwritten, and I had read the autobiography of Malcolm X, but those were the only two books that I kind of looked to as example of, you know, good ghostwritten books. But I, you know, I just talked and interviewed and looked at the transcripts and typed them out. And then when I typed them out, I said, well, that's not him, because, you know, the eye hears differently than the ear. You know, if you have a transcript of me talking now to you and you read that transcript in a literal way, that isn't me. I mean, that, and so it that was an epiphany, in that I began to understand that, that ghostwriting is an art form, in that art is artificial, that it's artifice, that in other words, I had to artfully recreate his voice on the page. And that required editing, using certain phrases or whatever this. And to tell you the truth, I still don't know exactly what I'm doing, because I do it by instinct. But I did do it, and people read it and they thought, well, it really sounds like him. So that I found that I had a sort of a gift for this weird thing. And I enjoyed it. I mean, I liked pretending I was him, and I liked trying to please him. And because I had been in advertising, I was used to working with a client, and I just kind of saw him as the client whom I had to please. So it was a much different paradigm than anything I had learned as an undergraduate or in graduate school, which is, you know, find your own voice. No, find his voice, you know. So everything changed, you know, once I saw. And then the other thing that I loved about being a ghostwriter is that when I heard Ray speak, I heard the kind of musicality of his voice, because, you know, we learn to speak before we learn to sing, and his singing voice comes out of his speaking voice. So, you know, the way he'll cut off certain words and scream and laugh. And so I knew that the root of his musical individuality was in his speech. And then it occurred to me, oh, I'll be making music that the prose that I write has to sort of mirror his music. And that was an exciting thing, and it remains that. So it remains so to this day. I've started working with the rappers, Snoop Dogg, and on a book, and man, to try to get his rhythms and rhymes down on the page is just a great challenge. And even though I've been doing this for 45 years now, every new gig is still, how am I going to create this person as a literary character in which the ear will hear and the eyes will hear, and so on and so forth. So anyway, that's a very long answer to your short question about how I got the gig. But that's how I got the gig.
Well, that's what we're looking for, is to hear your stories. And so you mentioned in the book that after Brother Ray came out and is successful, that you thought, oh boy, Stevie Wonder and James Brown are going to be beating down my door. But it doesn't happen. Right. And you have to get out there and hustle again, and you hustle your way into your next big project, which is the great Marvin Gaye. How did you land this one?
Well, that was also another hustle. And by the way, I'm still hustling. You know, I'm still chasing after people. But in the case of Marvin's, how I sort of managed that was an album came out he did called Hear My Dear. And it was I thought it was a brilliant work, and it was attacked by the LA Times. And it's a very idiosyncratic work about his divorce from Anna Gordy, who was Eri Gordy's sister. And any event, the LA Times attacked it, and I answered the attack. And my hope was, well, first of all, in answering it, I was completely genuine because, I mean, I was absolutely crazy for the album. And I still am. I mean, I still put it up there as one of his great
I think time has vindicated you on that one.
I think so, you know, but it's taken a while. And like when it came out, everybody, who cares about his personal divorce? But I said, man, this is like, you know, Ingmar Bergman or something, you know, scenes from a marriage. But in any event, I wrote this letter to the LA Times comparing Marvin to Ellington and Charles Mingus and Stevie Wonder, and he's misunderstood. And my hope was that Marvin would read the letter and call me, and he did. And we got together, and he had read the Ray Charles book and was interested in doing his own book. And I had no idea of the chaos of his personal life. I just knew that, unlike Ray, which was a great experience, but I was kind of scared throughout it. I mean, I learned to chill after a while, but I mean, Ray was much older than I was, tough as nails, very strict. And, you know, and you always had to be on your guard. And you know, he kind of ran his organization militaristically. And you know, so that whole old-time James Brown, Ray Charles R&B thing, if your shoes aren't polished, you get fined, and so on and so forth. So Marvin was the opposite. You know, he was like an older brother. He was very relaxed. You know, we could get high together. And he was devastatingly charming. And not that Ray wasn't charming. He had his own kind of brand of charm. But Marvin was very, very loose and very intellectual and Christian and extremely Christian. I mean, deeply Christian and sort of knowledgeably Christian, but also knowledgeable about Islam and Buddhism and so forth. So, I mean, it wasn't his Christianity, even though he was born in a kind of a form of parochial Christianity, he had gone beyond that, even though he reached it. Anyway, it's a long, complicated thing. But his he spoke of Christianity and particularly of Jesus in a way that was sort of irresistible. Now, part of its irresistibility was because it was rooted in his music and his speaking voice. And for all of those of us who love Marvin Gaye's singing voice, part of what we know about his singing voice, it is extremely seductive, as was his speaking voice, so that he spoke very quietly and gently and sweetly, and did have a sort of ministry that was, you know, evident in what's going on. He had me, you know, reading books and talking to him. And I think, you know, it isn't that he tried to convert me. He didn't. He just, I was interested. And part of why I was so interested in his relationship to Christianity, because he had such a bad relationship with his father, who, you know, wound up killing him, and who was a preacher. And so my question in my head was, how could you still believe, you know, in Jesus when you grew up in this kind of crazy atmosphere, crazy household in which, you know, your father physically abused you and mentally abused you and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so that's what kept me hanging in there with Marvin, was that his relationship to Christianity was so strong. Now, it isn't that it wasn't without equivocation. He did have some equivocations. And again, we don't have enough time here because it could take 14 hours. And I'm not sure even then I could explain the whole thing that I tried to explain in my book. But the whole bottom line was, when Marvin was right, you know, when he was straight, when he was, you know, not crazy high, because, you know, later in his life, he, you know, became addicted to cocaine and then crack cocaine, and he, you know, literally lost his mind. But when he was right, I felt as though I could see, you know, the Jesus in him. Now, I don't mean he was Jesus, but there was something very beautiful about Marvin's spirit, and the beauty of his spirit is the same beauty that I heard in his music.
And the two of you collaborated and created something beautiful, his last great hit single, Sexual Healing. So let's hear that for a second.
Well, anyway, the short form of the story is we're in Ostend, Belgium, and he's in exile, and the IRS is after him for taxes, and he's off of Motown because they released an album with his approval, and he's got a new deal on Columbia, and he has his track that he loves that was written by his keyboardist, Odell Brown, and it's kind of this, you know, this kind of reggae-tinged track, but he doesn't have a story for it. And we're just kind of sitting around and talking, and there's on the coffee table, there's a kind of an avant-garde book of S&M cartoons, and I look at it and I say, you know, this is some sick shit. What you really need is sexual healing. And he says, well, what is that? And I said, well, it just seems like it's, you know, you kind of love a person and they love you back and there's no pain and there's no torture and you're healed of whatever. So, I mean, I guess I was being somewhat judgmental about S&M, but in any event, that was the nature of our conversation. And he was hit by the phrase and he said, that's really intriguing. Why don't you write a poem about that? And so I did. I just, you know, in blue teardrops and falling. So, you know, in about 5 or 10 minutes time, I wrote out the what became the lyrics to the song, and I gave it to them, and it was almost like every word had a note attached to it, and he forged a melody over the words. But the song was really, it kind of worked two different ways. It was, because I'm a ghost writer, I was able to write the song because I needed to give him a script. In other words, he needed language that he didn't have. And really, the one of the most fundamental jobs of a ghostwriter is to give language to people who need language. And they have the language down there somewhere in them, but, you know, the ghost has enough chops or enough furtiveness to create the language. But in a certain way, it was a ghost written song for Marvin Gaye, but it also turned out to be autobiographical for me, that I realized that, and it took me a long time to come to terms with the fact that I had a sexual addiction and I needed sexual healing and, you know, needed to go into 12-step programs for sexual compulsivity. And so it goes very, very sort of deep for me. And you know, that's the irony of it. You know, wrote the song for him, turned out to be I really wrote the song for me, you know. But that took another, I don't know how many years. I wrote in 82, I don't think. Yeah, I went into the program in 95, so it took me 13 years to apply the song to myself, which is kind of crazy, but, you know, it just takes as long as it takes.
Yeah, and after you collaborate on the song with him, then the album comes out, you're thanked in the acknowledgments, but there's no credit.
Yeah, so we had a legal fight that I fortunately won because I had a tape recording of us writing the song together. So it, you know, it was a pretty easy case to win, but also he was not, I mean, he was ill, you know, he was so hooked on kind of crack and you know, had suicidal thoughts towards the end, and his whole decline was, you know, really sad. And so, you know, I wasn't angry, and I'm not angry now. I mean, I'm kind of grateful that I got to sort of meet him and know him and write a book about him and write a song with him. And now I've actually written two books about him, because I also ghost wrote the book of his second wife, Jan, whom I adore, a book called After the Dance. And that's her autobiography about her life with Marvin. So I got to revisit his story from another person's point of view. And at the only other time that's happened to me has been with Aretha, interestingly enough.
And tell us about Aretha. That's the next big subject in your book.
You know, it was another me being a crazy guy. I mean, just as I chased after Ray Charles with those telegrams and Braille, and just as I had written the LA Times defense of Marvin's album as a way to meet him, I met Aretha when I was writing Ray Charles's book in maybe 1978 or 79, and I asked her, do you want to do a book? And she said, nope. But I didn't take no for an answer, and years went by, and every year I would write her postcards and letters, and I made a point to meet her sisters and her brother, and I did a book with her producer, Jerry Wexler, and I became friends with Luther Andros, another of her producers. And anyway, I just kept after her. And then one day I was in Detroit and she called me and she said, let's talk. I want to do a book. And man, I think that was one of the happiest nights of my life, because it was basically Ray, Marvin, and Aretha were the three people I wanted to write books about more than any other people. And now I was going to get to do it. And people told me, man, she's so guarded, you aren't ever going to get it. You know, you aren't ever going to get to the truth. And I kind of said, I'm going to just dig down, and whatever charm I have, I'm going to dig it up and be so sweet and loving. She'll never be, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I didn't do it. I didn't make a dent in her armor. I mean, we had some very pleasant evenings in her kitchen eating chicken and her vanilla pudding and listening to gospel music and jazz. And I don't mean we didn't have some pleasant times, but in terms of getting the nitty gritty, I just didn't get anywhere. And I knew the story because I had done Jerry Wexler's book and Smokey Robinson's book. And I had, you know, I knew a lot about her. And like I said, I came prepared with interviews that I had done with her brother and her sisters. But I just couldn't get anywhere. And she had this idealized view of her life. And I began to understand at a certain point that was her kind of strategy for survival. And I had to respect it. You know, sometimes things are too painful to address. So rather than address them, we idealize them. So anyway, finally, I gave up and she kind of pushed me off the project. She kept my name on the book, but she didn't have me involved in the editing or the final drafts, and the book came out and I was, you know, really disappointed in it. And it didn't do anything because I think there wasn't that much in it, though it's very interesting. I mean, I think it's an important kind of document to understand her, because this is how she understood her story. So, I mean, I think scholars in years to come will and should, you know, read her book. But I knew it was a deeper story, a more complicated story. And about 11 or 12 or 13 years went by, and I just couldn't live with the idea that that I hadn't told the Aretha Franklin story as I knew it. And I didn't want to be a biographer. You know, it goes back to my earlier discussions about having discovered my talent as a ghostwriter. And the only reason the Marvin Gaye biography turned into a biography, because he was killed before I could get through writing the book, and he wasn't there to approve it. So I had to do a biography, though if you read that book, Divided Soul, you see that he probably one third of the book is written in his voice, because I had so many interviews with him. But anyway, getting back to Aretha, I just made up my mind, if I don't do this book, you know, who's going to do it? I mean, who kind of knows her sisters and brothers and producers, and who knows her? And I knew her. I mean, I had worked on her autobiography for 2 years, and it hurt because I knew she'd be angry. And part of what a ghostwriter does is want to keep, as I said before, the client happy. And I knew she wouldn't be happy. But I figured I had a higher calling here, which was to, you know, leave an historical document that was accurate and that reflected the complexity of her art and the complexity of her personality. So I wrote a long biography of Aretha Franklin, and she wasn't happy. And I wasn't happy that she wasn't happy, but I knew she wasn't going to be happy. And it came out, and it's out there, and now there are two books. There is her autobiography, and there's my biography, and I'm glad that I did it, but I don't especially want to do it again. Like I said, I feel like my calling is as a ghost writer, and
We're very grateful that you did, because it's an excellent book.
You.
And I want to cue up our next song, which is Aretha Franklin doing her live Amazing Grace album covering Marvin Gaye's Holy Holy. So here's Aretha doing Holy Holy.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And that was Aretha doing Marvin Gaye's Holy Holy, which was a little bit, I don't know if controversial is the right word, but it was sort of an unusual call for her to do pop song like Holy Holy in the context of a gospel concert. She also did Carole King, a medley involving a Carole King song in that same show.
And also it's important to put that in context too, because, you know, by now the Amazing Grace, documentary is out, which I think is great. I mean, I think it's just a beautiful, beautiful film. But, you know, you got to remember that Church is done in, you know, 1971, 1972. 72 is the time zone. Marvin just put out What's Going On, and Carole King just put out Tapestry. So in addition to doing contemporary old gospel, she wants to do contemporary songs as well and kind of gospelize those. And the case of doing Holy Holy, when I hear it, I just get, you know, I just get goosebumps. I mean, it's such a beautiful, beautiful rendition of a song. And Marvin Gaye's a hard artist to cover. But he also wrote the song as a soul gospel song. So, I mean, it just made perfect sense that she would do it. And it's so I'm glad that you played it.
Yeah, it's, you know, if anybody's going to take on Marvin Gaye, it has to be somebody as titanic as Aretha, and she really pulls it off. And then, you know, those are the sort of the three primary figures in your tale of your musical and spiritual quest. But you mentioned several other artists that you ghostwrote for and the way that they helped you. And so I'm just going to throw some names out there and let you tell kind of quickly how they contributed to your quest. And so how did B.B. King, what advice did he offer you?
Well, I mean, it isn't so much advice as just who he was. I mean, he was a very beautiful man. He was a very sweet man and very kind of grounded. And he actually often went to Aretha's father's church when he was in Detroit. So he was a Christian. He was also not a proselytizer. He had a kind of easy relationship. There was a kind of an easy spirituality about B.B. that I found very, very attractive. I mean, and also one of the things I loved about B.B. was because, you know, he'd often talk about God and what God meant in his life. And I would, you know, say, well, why didn't you become a gospel singer? And, you know, he told this story over and over again about being a kid and being in gospel groups and then going on the streets and singing gospel songs and with his guitar, and people would come by and give him a grin or give him a hug. And then he would sing a blues song and they'd put a dime or give him a quarter or half a dollar. And that's why he became a blues singer. So, I mean, I just love, you know, the honesty about it. But ultimately what I came to understand and what I believe now, and B.B. was, I guess, one of the people who taught me that just by being in his company for a couple of years, was that there is no real difference between the gospel singer and the blues singer when it comes down to, you know, articulating or expressing the love energy. And so ultimately, I think, you know, there's this, I think on the album on the Aretha live at the Fillmore, when Ray comes up and sings Spirit in the Dark, she calls him the right Reverend Ray Charles. And I think, you know, B.B. was a preacher. I think Buddy Guy was a guy that I work with, is a preacher. I think there is sort of a musical ministry, certainly, you know, John, who I never met, but I think John Lennon had a musical ministry. And I think these great, great artists minister to us. And I think that's why the form is so powerful. And Etta James was another example of a person like that, who began in the church and then became an R&B singer and a blues singer and a jazz singer and everything else. But she was basically sort of ministering to people through her music. I have a lesbian friend of mine said the first time she was with a woman, she heard the record of Etta James singing At Last playing when she embraced a woman. And I just kind of thought to myself, wow, what a kind of a holy, sacred moment that had to be. And so I don't distinguish anymore. I mean, I think, you know, you pray, you meditate, you listen to music, and music of all those forms is the one that elevates and excites my spirit the most.
And mentioning Etta James, you've got a great quote in here, and it ties in with the theme and adds sort of a dual meaning to the term ghost, which is a big figure in this book. But she's talking about how when she had learned to sing, that the spirit would fill her. And she says, I can see, and she's talking to you, and she says, every time you start playing me some old Billie Holiday jam you think I should know about, I see you get all ghosted up. He's all up in you. You just don't know what to call him. Talk a little bit about that and the meaning of.
Well, I mean, because I think Etta saw me, as did Marvin Day, as did, you know, Marvin Gaye and other people, as a Christian, or at least, I mean, she got it where I was scared of it. I mean, you know, being Jewish and, you know, growing up in a Jewish household, having a Jewish wife and children, and I didn't want to kind of claim it. It's too creepy. It's too, you know, whatever. You know, there's that Woody Allen movie, I forgot which one, where he's toying with spirituality, and he walks through us, and he's walking down the street, and there's like a bobblehead Jesus winking at him. I mean, I mean that was me. I mean, it was like, no, I don't want this. And so when Etta, when people like Etta would tell me you're all ghosted up, or it's just I just knew it was true. And so to actually, and I guess the sort of biggest, there's a story in my book where I'm a preteen or just a teen, and our family has moved from the East Coast to Dallas, and I'm in the black neighborhood looking for jazz to hear, and I feel very estranged from the world because I hated Dallas when I first moved there. And I walk by a black church, and there's a choir, and there's singing, and there's joy in the church, and I want to go in. And a woman comes up to me and says, what's your name? And my speech impediment disallows me to get my name out. I stutter like crazy. And she said, it doesn't matter. Jesus knows your name, and come on in. And I couldn't go in. And I had my nose pressed against the glass, and I didn't go in till I was 60 something years old. And I didn't, and I wouldn't go in if Etta James or Marvin or any of these people hadn't say, I really see you. I really know your heart, and you know, your heart, you know, loves God, because this music is God. And, you know, and I call it the God groove, because the groove gets to me before anything. I mean, I just like beats. I mean, when I read, I can't read authors who don't have a, who don't have some sort of ism. And when I write, I try to establish a groove. So you turn the pages and you feel like there's some sort of syncopation that kind of lubricates the prose. And that groove, which drew me to, you know, jazz and rhythm and blues and gospel, is, I think, you know, the heartbeat and the, you know, some kind of cosmic groove that organizes time so that we're not bored and we are transformed. And that groove is God to me. But because God is inaudible and invisible, it's tough. You know, it's tough even talking to you now without, you know, finding the right words, because underneath it all is its sort of mystery. And why somebody loves a Dolly Parton song or a Johnny Cash song or a Bob Dylan song or a Dexter Gordon song or any song that speaks to their heart is mysterious. And that connection, that kind of loving connection between us and music is mysterious, and you know, you can have computers and analyze it with beats and how many beats per second equal a hit song, and I understand, you know, high tech, and I like high tech, and I like electronic music, and I love disco, and it, you know, it isn't that it's just got to be a gospel singer singing alone. I mean, I like a lot of music, but at its heart is mystery. And I don't know what else to call it, but God, and because it makes me feel good, and it makes me want to be more loving and compassionate and understanding. And that goes back to being a ghost. You know, to be a good ghost writer, you can't judge the person you're working with. You have to show them empathy. You have to show them compassion. You have to show them curiosity. And that is, you know, a gift I've been given. I mean, I've often thought, because, you know, I grew up, my dad loved all the big time authors, you know, Philip Roth and Saul Bellow and Bernard Malamud, and before that, the great Russian authors, Dostoevsky and blah, 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 you know, kind of high cultural stuff. And that's who I thought I had to be. That's what I thought art was. And if I had hit it, if I had made it, and I tried, I mean, I wrote a couple of sort of novels. It's a whole nother long story, but in any event, I just never made it big as a novelist. And my main source of income and how I have survived as an artist has been as a ghostwriter for 45 years. Had I made it as like a brand named author, where people, because, you know, people don't go out and buy my books. They buy a book because it's about B.B. King or Etta James or whoever. So I don't really have an audience. But had I made it as a big-time author, where, you know, the David Ritz brand, David Ritz's next book will be about a dog or a horse or World War II, I don't think I would have ever come to faith the way I have. I think I would have been trapped up in my ego, which is still kind of a struggle for me. I don't mean that I've won that battle entirely because I have a big ego, but I've been checked. I've been checked because to be a good ghost, you got to check your ego. But had I become a big time author, man, I'd be ego tripping like crazy. And I don't think I would have ever found the humility or had the curiosity. It just would have been a whole nother trip.
And let's close the show with one last song. This is a song performed by Ray Charles, but written by another person that you knew, Percy Mayfield.
Oh, great.
A song called The Danger Zone.
All the time. That's because I've got a worried mind. You know the world is in an uproar, yeah.
And that was Ray Charles doing Percy Mayfield's Danger Zone. And I picked that because he had a quote in there that he felt songwriting was akin to creation and the way God is, and finding order out of chaos. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I mean, Percy was just a hugely talented guy. I mean, he's the only guy I really know who spoke poetry. I mean, but was very, very kind of street and poetic at the same time. But he was a bit of a prophet. I mean, you know, he wrote "Please Send Me Someone to Love," which has been a song. It's been a standard forever, but he had a chaotic life and was in a terrible car accident at a certain point. And his head was kind of ashed in, and his face was disfigured. And yet, when he would speak, he would talk about how the creation of his songs came out of the chaos and confusion of his life, and to give that chaos and confusion form, whether it be a 12-bar blues or a more standard ballad, was the only way he kept from going crazy. And you know, somebody asked me at a conference once, what's the main job of the author? What's the author's primary task? And my answer was two things. And that is just me talking, you know, every author gives it. But to me, the author's main task is not to go crazy. And I don't say that lightly, because, you know, lots of authors have gone crazy, and a lot of absolutely brilliant authors have gone crazy. But I see it, I don't want to go crazy. You know, I don't want to lose my mind. I don't want to go nuts. I don't want to have a nervous breakdown. So I have to work on not going crazy. And then I said the other thing, for me, the other main goal I have as a writer is to make a living. Because I don't want to do anything else but write. You know, it's my joy and my passion, my way of making music. And if I don't make a living, I'll go crazy. Or if I go crazy, I won't be able to make a living. So I got to do both those things. Those are always my first two priorities. You know, make a living and don't go crazy. And I think Percy was one of the people who really made that clear to me, that he was working to keep sane. And of course, you know, we know a lot of artists who've gone insane.
And that, I think, sums it up pretty well. The book is The God Groove, and this David Ritz. David, it's been a treat. I've been reading your books for years without
knowing. Well, I appreciate your calling, man. Yeah, and I appreciate your giving me all this time. I've enjoyed it.
It's a treat. It's a treat. And hopefully we can have you back on maybe 15 times, because there's so many great books to talk about.
Thanks. Okay, brother.
All right. Thanks, David.
Be sure and subscribe to the Let It Roll podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Podomatic, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Let It Rollcast. Come back next Monday when Ted Anthony joins the show to discuss his definitive history of the song House of the Rising Sun and its journey from the hills of Tennessee to New Orleans, New York, and Newcastle upon Tyne. The God Groove, A Blues Journey to Faith, is published by Howard Books. Please support our show by ordering via the Amazon referral link on our website, letitrollpodcast.com.